It's a warm welcome at the First Light Friendship Center in downtown St. John's. Unreserved producer Amanda Gear is meeting up with three of the center's elders.
Gwen and Deloisi Marjorie Muse. I just said hi. My name is Marjorie Muse, and I'm from Bay St. George. It's a little community on the western portion of Newfoundland.
Emma Reelis. I was a Ford, Emma Ford, and I was born in Nain, Labrador. And my grandparents are Emma and Amos Voisey from Voisey's Bay. I always gotta put them in because I like for them to know, yeah. You know.
Let everybody know who you came from.
Where I came from, that's right.
Ellen Ford, and I was born and raised north of Goose Bay. Nain is the community's name.
Ellen, Emma, and Marjorie have been coming to this Friendship Center for over 20 years. Emma first learned about the center from a woman at the supermarket who invited her to its annual general meeting. The next thing she knew, she was put forward to sit on the center's board. But at the time, she wasn't confident that she could do it.
So Myrtle put my name down to Myrtle or Danny Pottle, one of them, put my name in to be on the board, for the board. And I said, no, I'm not smart enough for that, you know. And I said, no, I wouldn't be interested. The reason why I said I wasn't educated enough or you know, knew enough to be involved, because I was a residential school survivor, right? And when you're in a residential school survivor, I mean, you're wasn't treated very good. You're a stupid Eskimo or something like that, right? So,
with some encouragement, Emma did join that board and went on to serve as a member for several years. Nowadays, she still spends time there as an elder, meeting community where they're at.
Saying we help community, people coming out of corrections, people being homeless, and people that got no one to talk to. And we, you know, like eating them, gives them food, you know. And we come in here and we drum for them and talk to them and light the holy lamp and Marjorie Spudges. And they love it, you know. I mean, this is like home. I have the grandchildren here, right? Because people come in here, I mean, they don't stop laughing till the time to go sometimes.
Yeah.
And they don't want, and time just flies like that, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's a home away from home.
Tante Anin, Buju, hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. There's a rich history of friendship centers across Turtle Island. People gather there for essential resources, a connection to culture, and, well, friendship. Jocelyn Formsma says these community hubs have humble beginnings.
Friendship centers started really in the kitchen tables.
The centers continue to evolve as the needs and the dreams of their communities inspire them. Like in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, where Shane Bird is building a space for ceremony for future generations.
So we're trying to dedicate this land, you know, for ceremonial and cultural use, so that 10, 20, 50 years from now, it'll still be standing. Maybe 100 years from now.
Today, your neighborhood friendship center is calling. Let's head in and find out why they're a place for learning, healing, and community connection.
Thank you for welcoming me. It's really important. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yourself?
Good.
Nice to meet you.
Who is your best friend growing up?
The thing with me, like, I guess you would call me an airline brat. Mm-hmm. I moved around a lot. So I moved around in so many different communities that I kind of had a friend in each community.
Yeah. Leah Randell knows the power of a good friendship, or in her case, many friendships. And these days, she finds some of her best ones at the First Light Friendship Center in St. John's.
I will say now, too, my elders are my best friends right now because they provide so much comfort, support, strength. And that's what I need for myself.
Leah is the cultural support worker for the Elders Program at First Light. Every week, anywhere from 5 to 10 elders meet there for a couple of hours of cards, chats, and plenty of laughter. She invited Unreserved's Amanda Gear to the program to see these friendships firsthand.
What is a friendship center?
Friendship Center for me is a coming together of communities, and that is of all Indigenous communities and also allies. It is so that people can come together to learn, to grow, support each other, communicate with each other. That's how we get to know our elders. That's how we get to know our knowledge holders. That's how we get to know people within the community. It is the biggest support, I think, that we need in an urban setting. I truly believe that friendship centers allow us to feel connected in ways, and again, like even with allies, with that in order to reconcile, we need friendship centers for people to come together and to grow and feel supported.
Yeah, reconciliation isn't a path taken alone. Mm-hmm. It won't work. Yeah. It won't work. And what goes on here? What kind of programs do you have? What do you see happening on the daily?
There's a wide variety of programs. Because we are now into many different buildings, there are programs that are cultural-based of crafting, yoga. It might be like the Inuit family program, those kinds of things. However, we also recognize that we have folks who have been in and out of incarceration, who may have mental health issues, addictions, that may struggle going to certain kind of programs and will need other programs for support. And therefore, we also have peer support program, we have a men's group for folks, and we also have the elders program, which I also think is not only, that is a more open, broad for everyone, but again, that is about connection. That is about community coming together, where a lot of the times our folks may find it difficult to come together. We provide that safe, brave space so they can come together, because not everyone can go and see a friend down the road or across town. No one always can have the ability to go and see an elder or a knowledge holder. This is what the elders program provides. It provides support for our elders, and it provides them to be able to provide support for us and for staff. So I think First Light in general is a great support and connection for everything, and it envelops all community, you know, for everybody and all their needs.
I got involved in kind of a quirky way with the First Light. I joined up for culture camp. Yeah. It was online at the time. And I used to be a hairdresser for like 15 years. I asked Ashley when I picked up my package for camp, I'm like, do you guys need a hairdresser? And she's like, what do you mean? I'm like, do you need someone to... Yes, I used to go to men's program, yeah, youth program, teaching braids. I went to elder program and cut hair. But that's how I started here, cutting hair, which I loved. Mm. I thought it was a great way to connect, right? Yeah. Really important, especially during COVID, no one could get their hair cut.
And then again, we have a lot of community members. Some people will forget that most people can't afford or get to something like that. First Light looks at the things that we need that most people will take for granted. So therefore, we look within ourselves as a team at First Light to see what our community members and our elders truly need and work with that and what we can bring into programs for those needs, because people will forget not everyone can get a haircut. Not everyone can go and get something special done for themselves. So this is something that we hope that we can provide for them.
Yeah. You definitely do. There's every nook and cranny is filled here, I think, with all the needs. Why is a place like this needed, Leah?
So that we can all learn from each other. We can all grow from each other, and we can all support each other. In Indigenous communities, elders and knowledge holders are a great support. However, we're also recognized that we have to make sure that they're feeling supported at the same time. It's a place where they can come, and there's no judgment. We help with navigating supports in the community that they may not know how to do. They need folks that are within the urban setting with a lot of our folks that aren't used to urban setting. How do I get to this system? How do I get to this program? How do I get to this support? This is what we're here for, is to help navigate so that they can feel comfortable and safe and be able to be out into an urban setting, because this can be quite a scary setting. And some people will come here for medical, they're already in a vulnerable state. You're with or without your family. So First Light is there. We have our IPNs that are helping you within the healthcare system. We have your medical transportation, we have cultural support. you know, language interpreters, we have our elders, we have to know that people coming in and for circumstances like that, they need to be able to feel okay. When you walk into the Health Science Center, it could be quite intimidating. So I think First Light recognizes, again, the importance of so many different avenues.
Yeah. You're doing great work here, Leah, and it's really meaningful to everyone in community. What does it make you feel like? What does it mean to you to be such an imperative role here at the Friendship Center?
Fills my cup. And I just said that the other day. I tend to say my elders, and I don't mean to, because they're our elders. I've always spent time with my elders, but to have the opportunity to spend time with them the way I get to also provide now space for staff, because we often say, speak to your elders. We say that to our community members, but what about us? We've done that. To see how it has helped the community and community reaching out and asking about elders program. To see people in peer support that are now regularly coming. Mm-hmm. Men's group who are regularly coming. And what it's saying is the need is there. And First Light is trying to work ways to provide that, you know, so that everybody in every part of their life feels supported. You know, when if you're incarcerated and you walk out and you don't have anything, you know, what do you do? First Light is, it has the understanding of we need to be able to support this person to the best of our ability. That warms my heart that we are there to provide that space, whatever that looks like.
Leah Randall is Enoch from Happy Valley, Goose Bay. She lives in St. John's and is the cultural support worker for the Elders Program at First Light. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we're shining a light on Friendship Centers, a movement that started in 1954 with the Kokolitsa Fellowship Club in downtown Vancouver.
How are you?
This Friendship Center in St. John's has been supporting the community for more than 40 years.
They just celebrated the 40 there last year, and we're reminiscing, and they put up a picture of me and the first traditional Mi'kmaq dancers on the island that me and my brother, Victor James Muse, who was the chief at the time, he would come in and bring the culture into St. John's Friendship Center, which was called St. John's Native Friendship Center at that time. And I would follow him around because he was my older brother, my favorite brother. And he would say, why don't you come into St. John's? Bring the drum in and you could teach some of the songs and do drumming and that. So I used to do workshops with a lady from Hopedale, I think Beatrice Hope was her name. And we would do, like, offer the different culture drumming and singing and in a language, bit of the language. I don't know much of the language, but I knew a lot in the songs I did. So I brought that to St. John's. And I started attending the circles, and I started attending the programs, and start being in the community and seeing what they had to offer, because I felt a disconnect where I grew up in my culture on the West Coast and was always like about culture, ceremony. So I wasn't feeling like I wanted to stay in Conception Bay South because I didn't get that connection. But when I joined First Light, it was like everything changed. When I go, I always go back to the youth because I love the youth, but when they come into the urban centers and they're going to university, say, so we go, the elders go over to the university and we offer support and things like that. But when they come in and they know that they have the Friendship Center, even for, like, you know how my kids, even yet today, they still come, Mom, what you got to eat? Or like something like that. So the Friendship Center offers these spaces where they cook these nice meals and they offer, you know, they have them in and they got these programs that they could, and then have finding those connections, and then all of a sudden they might get a part-time job out of it, or Friendship Centers can tell them, like, direct them places to go to find employment and who to contact, and they know their the people in the community, so they make them connections for them. And that's so important when you're away from home.
Oh, it so is, right? So important.
Who was your best friend growing up?
I love her to pieces. My best friend was Jenna Searle, but we were like always competitive. But she was still my bestie, but even though like she made me take her shoes in and take her, carry her books, take love letters to my cousin for her, so I missed my lunch break and my recess. But we had a connection, I think, through music, so we had that bond like through that. And but we're still friends today yet.
Oh, I love that.
That's Marjorie Muse, speaking with associate producer Amanda Gear. Marjorie is a Mi'kmaq elder from St. George's, Newfoundland and Labrador. She became a member of First Light Friendship Center when she moved to St. John's in 2010. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we're visiting Friendship Centers, your neighborhood hub for love. Friendship centers are a community cornerstone in many urban centers across the country, but they have humble beginnings, often started by grassroots organizers at kitchen tables who saw a need for the migration of Indigenous people moving into cities. The first three centers started in Winnipeg, Vancouver, and Toronto in the mid-1950s. They were access points to vital services and resources for Indigenous people living off-reserve. Now, there are over 100 locations spread coast to coast. As a young woman, Jocelyn Formsma became involved in her local center after being voluntold by a group of community aunties. It became a place of acceptance, support, and growth for her. Now, Jocelyn is the CEO of the National Association of Friendship Centers, established to represent the growing number of centers across Turtle Island. She says friendship centers aren't just physical locations. They're a movement. Jocelyn, welcome to Unreserved.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And thank you for being here. What is the friendship center movement?
The idea of a movement is not just these physical centers across the country that provide programs and services, but the people that are part of these centers really being at the forefront of a lot of community organizing. And we really call it like a civil society movement. So it's not governmental, it's not supposed to be institutional, it's like people helping other people without the overview of, say, any legislation or court order or anything like that. It's just volunteer-driven, community-driven, and really meant to be like, we're going somewhere. Like, we're moving along, hopefully, a continuum of activity for our community members.
Mm. Can you think of an example of the type of, you know, community engagement you're talking about that reflects a Friendship Center's purpose?
When news hits us nationally, there's often a Friendship Center local response to kind of hold space for community. So, for example, when there was the discovery of the anomalies in Kamloops, the residential school, you could feel the ripple effects across the country. And immediately, a lot of the Friendship Centers responded by ensuring people knew that there were mental health supports. Some Friendship Centers had sacred fires so people could come and offer tobacco or come and give their respects. And I think another center even kind of created a space where people could come and, you know, kind of hang these little orange shirts in a teepee. And then, of course, there's just more practical things around going in and saying, I need support. I need to know where I can go for these medical services. And is somebody available to come with me? We're having an issue with child family services. Like, is there any support that the Friendship Center can give me? And we know that we often will be asked to support families to try to keep families together or participate in some role in hopefully reunification. And that's either being the site of a supervised visit or the services that a Friendship Center offers, participating in a family plan for reunification if that's the plan, or providing training to say non-Indigenous foster parents and providing access to culture and community for children who might be in care who can't return to their families at that particular moment.
How did the Friendship Center movement begin?
Well, I've been fortunate to, you know, listen to a lot of the founders of the Friendship Center movement over the many years that I've been involved as a volunteer and in my current role. And I'll often hear them say Friendship Center started really in the kitchen tables. There has been a migration from, say, reserves or from people coming from the north. And as the migration was increasing over time, they would say, okay, well, you're going to the city, call so-and-so when you get there, they'll help you get set up. They call so-and-so, they go over to their house. Okay, what do you need? Well, I'm looking for a job. I need, do you know where I can go for a doctor? And sort of like these informal sort of referrals kind of sparked an idea of, like, as Indigenous women often do, we'll sit around kitchen tables or any table and be like, hey, you know what we need? Or, hey, you know what we should do? And I think just instinctively, we started into the organizing role. And then I think the service part of it kind of came afterwards, where instead of doing the referrals and saying, you should go here, you can go there, they said, you know what, we can just do it ourselves and we could probably do it better. And so as there was like a growing collective of friendship centers across the country, they established their provincial associations and they established the national association to give them a national voice, to advocate federally, and to provide a point of collective action at the national level around a national kitchen table where we said, hey, you know what we should do? We need to go down this road, or we need to inform people that this is happening.
Nothing more powerful than an Indigenous woman who says, you know what we should do?
And I'll caveat by usually when we say, you know what we should do, it's a thing, you know what you should do. Especially if there's some, nieces and nephews around the table, when we say, you know what we should do.
You're being voluntold is what you're doing.
Exactly. And I say that because I was one of those nieces at the local level when they're like, you know what we should do? And they all look at me like, oh, okay.
As you're backing away slowly.
Yeah, exactly.
Take me back to, if you're able to, what was happening, in the 1950s in particular, where we saw this sudden, need and rise of friendship centers. What was happening in our country at that time with Indigenous people that saw that need?
I wish I knew more about sort of that era and the timing and if there was, sort of a surge or whatnot, but it there does seem to be sort of a collective effort across the country. And we had this magazine that NAFC used to publish called The Native Perspective. And we actually have all of the editions, we digitized them and put them on our website. So if anybody's interested. Now, that only started in the 1970s after NAFC was established, but I think it gives a good glimpse into what was happening at the time. And in some ways, how far we've come from those days. And also how far we haven't come, like how you could read some of these articles today and be like, oh my gosh, we're still dealing with this. So I think there's a few things. I mean, we know that our people didn't get the right to vote until, the 1960s. By then, I think it was sort of the decline of the residential schools, but sort of the incline of the child welfare system kind of taking over. And I think there's a lot of probably push factors for people having to leave the reserve or coming south with respect to job opportunities, educational opportunities. And then as the community was growing in all of these urban centers, naturally we congregated, we got together, regardless of which community we were coming from, you kind of find community when you move to the urban center. And today I think, it's still like that where people are moving to the city, and I hear this a lot. The first thing they do is they call their local friendship center and say, what kind of programs do you guys have here? Like, I'm from this place, and oh, so-and-so is my mom. And sometimes, sometimes they're like, oh yeah, they used to come around here, Yeah, so I think there was a lot of things happening around the 1950s that sort of culminated in the establishment of these places and the need for coming together and need for community.
That's it right there, right? The need for community. What kinds of challenges did our predecessors face as they began to try and establish friendship centers?
I couldn't imagine in those times, like, nobody wanted to be us. Nobody wanted to be associated. And so I think probably finding support, like, I don't know how they were able to get funding in those days. You know, I think a lot of it in those days really relied on volunteers, people coming and doing things for free. You know, I have this, I'd like to offer it to support people. I couldn't imagine like the racism in trying to establish some of these centers, right? Like even to this day, as we're, you know, we know a few centers that are building or rebuilding new places in very visible downtown areas in some places, and people are like, well, you know, what do they need that for? Like, does it have to be so big? What are they going to do there? And being able to persevere and be positive. Like, I know the Friendship Center in Vancouver has been hosting the West Coast Nights forever. Like,
I've been to that. Many years ago, I've been there. I was there.
it's such an incredible thing to witness, right? Like, it's just,
Yes, it's beautiful.
if you can imagine having to spend your days trying to hide in plain sight and, you know, trying to get jobs and trying to afford a place to stay. And then, you know, your culture, like very recently not being illegal anymore, you know, being able to dance and still having these pieces of regalia and like being able to pull them out and say, tonight, behind the closed doors of these friendship centers, like we can be proud, we can be who we are, we don't have to hide ourselves. This is our space. And we can kind of take off the cloak that we have from the outside world, and we can just be here together and enjoy food and laughter and lots of tea and dance and music. You know, I can't imagine what that time would have been like. And I think there's still a lot of elements to that to this day. I mean, thankfully, you know, with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a lot of awareness has been raised, and there's a lot more embracing of Indigenous culture and a little bit more understanding. But I still think there's an element of like a cloak or a shawl that we still have to wear in public. And being in spaces that are all completely Indigenous, where we can just kind of take that off and just like take a breath and turn to the auntie beside you and just be like, you know, who made this fry bread is really good, you know. Dealing with a lot of racism, a lot of structural racism. I can't say, you know, we don't still deal with that to this day. I think it just looks a little bit different than it did, you know, in the 1950s.
Is it still a challenge to, get the funding for the bricks and mortar, the building that'll say Friendship Center on the front of it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think things have improved. I mean, we've been able to secure funding to build some new centers, to improve some of the centers that we have. But that's come from decades of advocacy, awareness raising. And I have to say, like, you know, I've done some international work, and when I talk about what we do and how we do it, there literally is no other example of the Friendship Center movement anywhere else in the world. Like, this is something that's uniquely ours in this region. And it truly is like a world-class example of, I want to use this term very carefully. When I say self-determination, I don't mean that in the nation sense. I mean that in, as people, we didn't wait around for somebody else to come and help us as Indigenous people. It was people who saw a need, who helped other people, and we just organized and made it happen. And I think, in a sense, that was us as Indigenous people, not waiting for anybody else to kind of do it for us. We just did it ourselves. And I think a lot of times when you have that kind of effort, the funding follows, because people see the outcomes, the positive outcomes, and they want to support that.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that you have a connection, a long-standing, voluntold connection to Friendship Centers. What is that connection?
I actually did my high school co-op at the Timmins Native Friendship Center back in, you know, 1999, 9. And it was about 18 years old. And yeah, I worked at the front desk of the Friendship Center answering calls. I was doing the faxing back in the day, you know, and had to fax people things, doing the mail runs and all that kind of stuff. And then I worked there as a youth coordinator doing youth activities, bringing them bowling and arranging karaoke nights and dances and that kind of stuff. And then eventually I was asked to sit on the board by a mentor of mine, who her name was Hannah Sutherland. She was like, I would really like you to come to the board meeting. And I, you know, I think I was like 19 years old by that time. I was like, yeah, that doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun. Why would I do that? And so she said, well, you know what, like, I'll pick you up, we'll go for food. So she brought me to the meeting. And one of the first meetings, they were having this conversation around the board table. And at one point, they were getting kind of sensitive what they were talking about. And they said, well, maybe our young person should step out of the room for this conversation, you know, kind of like adults are talking. And I didn't think anything of it at the time. So I stepped out. And a few minutes later, Hannah came and got me, and she brought me in back to the meeting and said, you know, if we're not willing to have these difficult conversations with our young people, how are they ever going to learn? Like, I tell this story a lot because there's a lot of aspects to that moment, and it's something that carries with me still to this day, that here's somebody who's respected in the community, a mentor, eventually somebody who was seen as, you know, maybe an elder in the community, who use their voice and their privilege and their power in a space to create space for me and my voice. And at the time, you know, I didn't think that my voice really had that much value. You know, what do I know? I'm just a kid. I'm just, you know, I'm a young person. But then allowing me access to these spaces so that I could observe, I could learn, I could understand. And so the next time that I was, you know, in a situation where there was a difficult conversation, you know, I could understand the way that I should be behaving in that. And I'll say to that point, you know, Friendship Centers already had a culture of youth engagement, which is why there was even that thought and that space for a young person at the board table. So I really credit Friendship Centers for being the launching pad that kind of put me on my career path trajectory.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. What an amazing journey you've been on. Such a spark. And now that you are in the position, what do you hope to do with that spark? What do you want to do with that burning flame in you in terms of the future of Friendship Centers?
We talk about sometimes this new era of Friendship Centers. So it's like, how do we take what we've built over the last 50 plus years? And I mean, some Friendship Centers are 60 or 70 years old, right? How do we take what we have, pull out those core fundamentals of, you know, community driven, community responsive, buy in for us, keep those core values intact, but then like elevate the movement to today's, you know, realities. And I think part of that is, you know, harnessing technology. I think part of that is getting a lot more deliberate about training our young leaders, providing a space for our collective Friendship Center leadership to come together, to share information, to build capacity, to have access to different kinds of opportunities. But at the same time, like, there's a sense of comfort. We don't want things to change too much that it's unrecognizable. Mm-hmm. Like, I always loved when I was at the Timmins Friendship Center, people could just walk in and grab a cup of coffee and sit down, and, you know, they didn't have to do anything. They could just kind of sit there. And most days of the week, there was some kind of lunch happening. So, you know, if they waited around long enough, they could go grab a sandwich and some soup. And, you know, I think I really like that aspect, that you could just walk in, you don't have to do or need anything. You could just kind of grab a cup of coffee, catch your breath, and if you wanted to talk to somebody about something, you could do that. So yeah, I think there's an aspect of keeping all of the great things that we've built so far, but then how do we make sure that we're prepared for the realities that are today and that might come down the line?
Jocelyn, thank you so much for your time today. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy that you've taken an interest in Friendship Centers. And yeah, it's been a wonderful ride, and I can't wait to see where we go from here.
Jocelyn Formsma is from Moose Cree First Nation in Northern Ontario. She's a lawyer and the CEO of the National Association of Friendship Centers. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, the power of friendship centers in building community. For some members, friendship centers are a place of healing. Unreserved's Amanda Gear recently visited with Ellen Ford at the First Light Friendship Center. Ellen told her about the friends that she's made there, many of whom share in her experiences as a residential school survivor.
Who was your best friend when you were at school?
You know something? I can't remember. I think I was so much alone, and that's how I felt all the time when I was in the dormitory. You know, it's making me think. Sue Ford was there as well. She was from further north, and she was in the dormitory that year. And she and I kind of used to talk to each other. So,
and not be so alone, I guess, hey?
Yeah, that's true.
How long have you been a part of the Friendship Center here in St. John's?
When did I come here? 1995, yeah. And I did work at the old building, and there was only 8 of us working then, and now look at it, 400 employees. It's good.
It's really good. Back when you used to work at the Friendship Center, what kind of programs did you have?
We had cultural programs, and the most popular one was people used to go out on the land, so we used to go to Salmon Airline and camp out there, and that was fun. A lot of people enjoyed it. And, of course, having country food. And there was only, total of about 8 or 10 of us employees working. We managed it somehow, and we all look forward to it.
And now that you don't work here, you're a member here, what's your favorite thing about being at the Friendship Center?
Well, the elder days, actually, and I look forward to coming, you know, when we come here on a Wednesday. The togetherness is what is important, I think, because there's people that come in that don't see each other. They know they're here in the city somewhere, but they meet with each other when they come here, and they enjoy it. And I think it gives you a good feeling. Being like home.
Yeah, for sure. I guess you made a lot of friendships through the Friendship Center. Do you have a best friend right now?
Well, Leah has come to be a best friend. Yeah. And it's really, it's good. It's good to have a good working relationship. And it's with someone who knows the culture and understands, you know. And I think that's important.
Ellen Ford is an Inuk elder from Nain Nunatsiavut and a residential school survivor. She comes to the First Light Friendship Center every week for its elders program. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Friendship centers have been around for half a century. That's a lot of friendships. But now that we've heard where they began, where might this movement grow? For one possible direction, we head to Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, known to some as the gateway to the north. In Cree, it's called Kistapananik, or gathering place. Indigenous peoples have been meeting there for hundreds of years. Today, it's still a meeting place. It's home to a large urban Indigenous community. And for many of them, the place to gather is the Prince Albert Indian Métis Friendship Center. Shane Bird is the Youth Services Director there. He's been working with young people at the Friendship Center for over 7 years. Shane has seen firsthand what the community needs to help navigate the impacts of intergenerational harms. And he and the Friendship Center have big plans for a new gathering place, one that will connect youth back to culture and ceremony. Shane, welcome to Unreserved.
Good morning, Rosanna. It's a pleasure to be speaking here today. My given name is Muskwaganeganeet, and I reside in the Treaty 6 territory, and I'm from Lac La Ronge, Niamban. My name that my parents gave me is Shane Nathan Wesley Bird, and I currently work and live in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction, Shane. And now before we get into the big reveal here, for those of us, you know, who have never been, tell me about your home of Prince Albert, Saskatchewan.
So our beautiful city is located just before we head to the north, you know, the gateway to the north, but it's also a gathering place for our Indigenous and non-Indigenous kin. It's a beautiful city, you know, and we have our ups and downs. We do deal with a lot of, you know, high incarceration rates, suicide rates, gang violence, you know, homelessness, addictions, mental health issues. A lot of people, a lot of urban members say we're the forgotten, you know, and sometimes that's true and sometimes it isn't. I can only speak like on my past, right? So, but I had a beautiful upbringing in the city, you know, we played lots of sports. There was lots of recreation going on. There wasn't as much programs and services growing up, but it's starting to come back, and that's what we're trying to accomplish with the center and our partners.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, we want to always focus on the positive things that are happening in our community, but I feel like people need to understand, like, what was the access for you or others growing up in Prince Albert to culture and ceremony?
It was very limited growing up. You know, we would always have to travel, you know, whether that to be to the surrounding First Nations. And, you know, I grew up with, you know, a low-income family. But my mother tried her best to make things a reality for us. It's hard to travel if you don't have a means of transportation or money for fuel, right, to travel to your home communities.
Mm. So accessibility was an issue for you and others growing up there?
Yes, definitely. And I think it still is to this day, you know, and that's what we're trying to help address, you know, with our partners and stakeholders.
You know, over the years, what we've clearly seen over and over again is that connecting people to culture, connecting people back to their identity and all of those things about being Indigenous really helps heal those traumas that we just talked about. So drum roll, please. What is the plan that the Friendship Center, along, you know, with the city, are endeavoring to address some of these barriers and challenges?
The big reveal is we're trying to bring an urban Indigenous cultural and ceremonial grounds for urban members in the city of Prince Albert in Kitsap-Annanic.
I love it.
And it's been an amazing journey with the city of Prince Albert. They've been supporting 100%. You know, we're having a huge community support. Before we even started, we did a community consultation, and we brought in lodges that replicated the signing of the treaty ceremonies. We consulted in our way with our non-Indigenous kin and with our late ancestors to honor them and to honor everyone that was coming out to be consulted. So that was our first step. And then we went to the table of the city and we met with them in their way, you know, to have that continuity that we're both meeting in the middle so that we can work together in unity. We meet differently. We don't meet in a boardroom. We sit on the ground, you know, we sing, we pray. And then everyone around that sacred circle has a voice. you know, so our non-Indigenous kin have been being grounded and see the power to be able to be part of this with us. We're developing our MOU agreement, MOU, mm-hmm. but it's actually reworded to a traditional land use agreement.
Oh, I like that.
So we have about 14 partners that are going to be doing a signing ceremony next month to sign this agreement. And this agreement will be renewed every 4 years to add for our future generations. So we're trying to dedicate this land, you know, for ceremonial and cultural use so that 10, 20, 50 years from now, it'll still be standing. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe 100 years from now. So we've also been, you know, developing, I don't like to call them projects. It's like life for me, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But at the cultural grounds, we're trying to, you know, bring an urban traditional powwow arbor. You know, we're trying to build a ceremonial hall so that families can have access to it when their past loved ones have gone to the spirit world. You know, we're trying to bring different ceremonies, weekly ceremonies, so our schools can have access to those, our youth can have access to those ceremonies, to the culture, to the land base.
It sounds like you got, you know, a lot of people, you know, the process seems really solid. You're bringing everybody in the circle. Everybody has a voice. Everybody has a say in trying to roll out this plan. So help me envision it. What would we see if we went to, you know, visit these cultural grounds?
It's located in Little Red River Park. So Little Red River Park is part of the city of Prince Albert. It's family orientated. It's community orientated. And you come into the park and then you go up to the Upper Eastern Plains. It's in a mistletoe wooded forest. And then when you come through the forest, it opens up into a beautiful plains, you know, so we have medicines there. We have different grasses there. It's almost like you're going back in time, you know. So if you look across, you know, the plains, you see beautiful teepees set up. You see lodges that are set up from the summer. So we're hoping that it continues to become, you know, what we envision and what we've seen in our ceremonies.
That sounds like it's going to be really beautiful. You're very clearly passionate about this, this process and getting this cultural grounds finished for, you know, for our future generations. What was the moment for you when you decided that this has to happen? I have to make sure my community has this, these cultural grounds.
Over the years, you know, like with my travels, I'm always traveling to all over the province to go to powwows and to go to cultural gatherings, to go to different ceremonies. And I travel with our youth. They always say, well, why can't we have this at back at home? And why can't we do this at home? And like even with dancing at traditional powwows, the kids are like, well, we've never been initiated. We don't have a community to be initiated from. And that just hit home. I get up every day and I think about our kids. And we understand that there's so much hurt that's happening to them. And we're losing too many too soon. And we need to bring the healing to our community. And it starts with our kids. And it's a tough job, you know, and it's a commitment that I made in my life, culturally, spiritually. You know, it's tough some days.
What keeps you going, Shane? What keeps you motivated? I see you're just getting really emotional here, and thank you so much for sharing that with me. But what keeps you motivated to make this dream come true?
It's my family and my extended family, my adopted nieces and nephews, you know, my wife, my kids, my past grandmother and mother. they're my rocks. You know, my wife is my rock. These kids are my rocks. They give me that strength that I need to continue to move forward, you know, to fight that good fight, you know, and to do it in a good way and not in a malicious way or not in a negative way. And you have to do it in a good way or you won't get very far, you know. So that's what keeps me going, what gives me that drive.
And how do you hope that, you know, this space, this cultural ground that you're helping to build will create that change, you know, for the youth that you work with and for the greater community in Prince Albert?
We've already seen positive effects with kids, you know, with youth that want to make change for themselves, you know, and to follow that sweet grass road and to live a healthy lifestyle, for also families to come and participate and to teach their young ones, you know, is a very positive impact, you know, in that kinship family system. I can see, like, the future, you know, let's say in 10 years, you know, if we've helped 1, 2, 3 families, you know, that's saying something. In 20 years, maybe we've helped 100 families. Those are 100 families that might have not have had the opportunity to heal or to get a chance to move forward from their traumas, right? So the elders always say to me, Shane, if you just help one person, you know, you did your job. And that's what I try to accomplish, is by helping, you know, at least one person or 10 people, 20 people, whatever it may be, right? It's trying to show that love, that passion for the work that I do for the community and for the youth.
Mm. Earlier you had said you wanted this, you know, these cultural grounds to be there in 100 years. So Shane, take me there. What does it look like in your vision of the future as you help heal that one family, that two family, the three families, and those kids that you are currently watching grow up right now? What does that future look like for you, ideally?
Ideally, the future looks for me is that, you know, that intergenerational trauma we had would be stopped in its tracks. You know, that's the vision that I see. That's, you know, what we would all want to see, right? You know, it just doesn't happen overnight. It'll take generations to come to stop that intergenerational trauma, but we have to start somewhere. If we have a young baby that's born today, you know, and their mother and father had healed from their traumas, then that young one will grow up intergenerational trauma free. Like I said, it takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of dedication. It takes a community, you know, because it just isn't one person. You know, we have, you know, 20, 30 people in the background, right? And we couldn't have been able to get to where we're at without that support.
That's a beautiful vision, Shane. Thank you so much for sharing some of it with me today.
Yeah, no, I'm very deeply humbled, and my heart is filled with love, and, you know, I'm grateful for you guys for reaching out, you know, and I'm honored to be able to speak on this.
Shane Bird is the Youth Services Director at the Prince Albert Indian Métis Friendship Center. He is Cree from Lac La Ronge Indian Band in Treaty 6 territory. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Rhiannon Johnson, Kim Kasher, Amanda Gear, Elena Hudgens-Lyle, and Caitlin King. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Inanaskamit Nawal. Egosay.